Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me is our TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. How are you doing, Winter?
I'm great.
All right. Journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
Hey, I'm pretty good, but there's no beer here at Mac
at all, or wine.
Yes. Somebody teetotaled for 10 months, and now she's gotten thirsty.
Exactly. I'm fired up, and this place has failed me.
And it's a pump and dump a day, baby. Pump and dump a day.
And pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Thompson.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers. I brought my clean canteen with me. Unfortunately, there's no bourbon in it this time. I know.
Karen, you're failing me too. I'm just drinking tap water.
We're all going to improve in the next year. Guys, tap water can be really satisfying sometimes.
Not in LA. Maybe in some other city.
Coming up on this week's show, we're chatting about I, Tonya, the true epic in this year's Oscar race.
Hell yes.
Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Oh, Lord. Omarosa getting tossed out jazz style Fresh Prince of Bel-Air of the White House literally for the second time in her life. And by the way, huge accomplishment. You can only get thrown out of the White House like once officially, but twice in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Huge.
Respect.
I loved that narrative so much.
Did you?
Her clawing her way through the office to try to get before Trump herself.
I visualized it in my brain because of all the seasons of Apprentice.
Yes.
So I know exactly her tactics, her moves, how she tried it, her facial expressions. And I saw John Kelly in my head, too. He was like, I'm just going to let you act like a crazy bitch if you want to.
A little bit, I imagined her with the leg cast that Melissa Rivers had when she stalked across the building to go back into the boardroom that one time.
The thing that's so amazing about it is that she's one of the few people in the Trump White House who has previous White House experience.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Wappler. This is true.
Like, that's how insane this whole administration is. Omarosa is like the experienced hand.
And then she hightails it to Manhattan the next morning to give everybody the exclusive and fails again to the point where you get Robin Roberts, the personification of mourning in like Sweden, like never goes too far to the left or to the right. She just is even and gave her a bye, Felicia. Yeah.
So why didn't she spill the tea? Well, like what would...
I honestly...
He wants to save it for a book or
something.
Yeah, I'm going to read
that. It's
going to be a bargain bin book. I think she saved it because she thinks she has a story. And she also thinks she's going to have the community from us. And speaking on behalf of all of the Black people, you can't sit with us. And you know this. I don't know who she's going to sit with. Karen, do the Filipinos want her?
I mean, there might be a couple who would. But they might, you know, be named Imelda and have, like, you know, hordes of shoes.
Well, it's that. I mean, it's kind of like a Kevin Spacey situation.
Yeah.
It's like, you didn't want us for so long, and now you want us to protect you in your time of need.
And it's like, no, honey, this is not the port for you to shelter yourself. I just think that, you know, there's nothing much else to say about it. She's whack. And that was a whack move. And at least she got great wedding photos out of it.
How many more disgruntled former employees can he create before we start getting, like, a real dish?
We got to start plucking people from, like, who still obviously have... It doesn't matter if you have access to the Oval Office at this point, right? Like, there's been people that have been kicked out that are still not talking.
Yeah.
Even Sean Spicer's dumbass was like, I just want to go to the Emmys. I mean,
I feel like Omarosa is our best hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
But she's going to have to give up everything and get 24-hour security because he'll kill her ass.
Oh, Crystal Ball, I'm
first.
Scared.
I'm
Crystal
scared.
Ball is out.
Yeah.
Winter, as a digital strategist, do you ever just send an email that's like, honey, I know you're in need right now?
I have like a list of 10 people that I really want to reach out to and be like, can I help you?
Yeah.
Name one.
Christy Brinkley, only because she sends all of her Instagram to Twitter and doesn't tweet. It's really annoying. She's a fucking supermodel, legendary at that. Just post
like,
the fucking
figure
picture.
Figure it out,
Christy.
Spend Love 10 it. Minutes.
Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I spend a lot of time just laying in bed trapped with my baby. And it doesn't always...
You make motherhood sound so trapped with my baby.
Yeah. It's the latest Lifetime movie. Have you heard of it? And you don't always get to watch a lot of like TV and movies because they make a lot of noise, blah, blah, blah. So I put in headphones. I try to listen to a lot of podcasts these days. And one that I've gotten into is Where Should We Begin, which is an Audible podcast, and it's hosted by Esther Perel, who basically is a psychoanalyst who has a book out right now called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. And she's from Belgium originally. She speaks 9 different languages. She has this like amazing accent where she just asks these people to tell them, you know, tell amazing details about their sex lives. And then they pour forth, and it's all kinds of people that agree to basically have their first session of marriage counseling taped by her. And yeah, and it's like you're a fly on the wall with people talking about their most intimate, deep, dark secrets and their kinks and their predilections and their hang-ups and everything. And it's delicious.
Do you listen to be like, oh, I'm learning about myself? Or do you primarily listen to be like, David and I are fine?
I mean, I would say more the first, because I do feel like each show I've learned something.
Yeah.
If only like a way to think about my own relationships or my own sex life. Like there's always some kind of dynamic in each session that is relevant to you in some kind of way, even if their problem is not your problem. But it's amazing just the range. Like, you know, there's one of the last ones I listened to is an Indian couple who basically they were both sort of forbidden to have sex before marriage. And now that they're married with kids, they don't really have any sexual fire because the whole kind of sneaking around, doing something you're not supposed to be doing is taken out of the equation. That was kind of a fascinating element to think about. There's a lesbian couple that basically have children, and one of them is super steeped in being a mother, and the other one really doesn't care about being a mother, and that's their conflict, and they're kind of banging heads against each other trying to figure that out. It's really fascinating.
I'm sorry, but just to loop Karen in on this, I thought the answer there was just like bring a third person into the relationship and everyone still lives in the same house.
That sometimes works itself out also with dogs as well as children. I've known people who've like shared dogs and the same apartment they were in together with the other person's new girlfriend, but you know, we're a very communal lot.
Margaret, do you think that America is ready for another older ethnic sexpert? Like
Dr. Ruth.
Yes. I was thinking about this. I was like, it's been a while since we've had Dr. Ruth's dulcet tones.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Telling us what to do with our sex lives. And so I feel like the time is ripe for Esther Perel. But
she's
also
been trying for so hard. I just need her to break through. She's amazing.
She's amazing. And I think her thesis basically that this latest book is spinning around is really relevant because she's basically saying infidelity is everywhere. It's rampant. More women in particular are doing it than ever. So clearly we can't just say like cheating's bad, nobody do it anymore. Like how do we recover? How do we talk about it? How do we think about it in a way that we can get something out of it in a relationship if we want to recover the relationship from it?
There's so much stuff on polyamory being adopted by normie society these days and by heterosexual married couples. There was just some article that I saw that came out about, like, particularly in some African-American communities where there's these unspoken agreements, like, between straight couples to, like, open their marriage. It's, you know, whatever, gay culture influencing everything.
Yeah. Monogamy is for relationships that are a system of ownership. once everybody is a free agent, then you can love somebody for who they are. Like, I understand how relationships work. Karen Thompson, what are you all about this week?
There is a new show from the BBC that is now streaming on Netflix. And it's a new cooking competition show called The Big Family Cooking Showdown. Has anyone seen this?
Not at all.
Okay, so it's two families facing off against one another. They're all facing off against each other in these heats, and then eventually there'll be the semifinals and the finals.
Oh, so Family Feud style, they have to do it together.
They have to do it together. So the episode that I just saw recently, you know, with one was just like an old Swedish-British grandmother, and then like her grandson and daughter, and then another a woman, her husband, and her mom, and they were cooking off against each other. And there are three parts of the competition in each episode. The first, they have to cook a lunch for under 10 pounds that feeds four people. So 10 British pounds, right? And they get to practice beforehand, right? So I guess they get to kind of practice beforehand, and then they are timed and they do their usual cooking thing. The second phase, the judges go to the family's homes. So they have to prepare a meal for them at their homes, which includes a dessert and an entree. And then the final showdown is Impress Your Neighbors, where they're cooking in the main kitchen again and have to, again, impress the judges. And it's a three-course meal. So the great thing about it is that you see a lot of subtle family dynamics. The grandmother, Torin, from the Swedish-British family, was totally an attention hog. And she was just more so obsessed with... because she was a former model in the 30s or something like that. And she just, she didn't want to be like whisking the aioli. She just wanted to chat with a host. So it's really, you know, it's super fun. It's from some of the folks from the Great British Bake Off. The winner, Great British Bake Off winner, Nadia Hussein, is one of the hosts, as is Zoe Ball. And there's an annoying Italian chef who has a Michelin star or something, who's one of the judges.
Okay, I worry that this is walking a tightrope, because God knows I love Great British Baking Show. But once you start getting into quick meals for busy moms, like once you get semi-homemade with Sandra Lee, I don't want to watch
these
it anymore.
Are not quick meals. These are elaborate, beautifully presented meals where they're making, you know, a spatchcocked chicken with Bengali spices and something that was called some form of pudding.
Presenting Bengali spices to Nadia is a ballsy move.
I mean, and when they're not Bengali, right? So there's a lot that's going on there.
It's funny. I recently rewatched two of the early seasons of Top Chef, and it's so weird to watch Top Chef back when they thought they were supposed to be reality stars instead of just people with tattoos who cook a lot. And there is that funny sort of like, showing off because you're trying to be a reality star.
Yeah.
That I can't tell if watching an old Swedish British lady do that would be charming or make me uncomfortable.
Well, remember they were giving everybody like restaurants, and now like since time has passed, you've seen that these restaurants don't survive.
Yeah,
even
some of them do,
or their food court thing, that food court show.
Yeah, they don't get a lot of them. Don't though.
Postmates in LA had an entire thing that was just restaurants from former. It was only like three
that's
or four
cute,
restaurants,
though. But that's what I'm saying. There was like I feel like there was 20 after when Top Chef first started.
Yes, it comes down to like if you win, you get to have a restaurant that survives. But if you come in third, you probably just live in Nashville now.
Ouch!
Okay. Nashville, damn.
That was me, like specifically shading Dale Levitsky.
Okay.
I was gonna say Nashville should be offended.
In the classic tradition of me watching Golden Globe nominated female centric shows only after Karen Tongson has made them her all about. You guys, I consumed all of The Marvelous Ms. Maisel over the course of the past week. And what a weird, amazing show. Like, it really is, it is the best things about Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino in that it isn't necessarily the kind of, like, 60-mile-an-hour language that you got from Gilmore Girls, but it really... what an interestingly observed Upper West Side it is. And I wanted to point to two things. The first thing is there isn't that much stand-up in the show. It really is a journey of a relationship and having a dude who is pissed off that he didn't get to have a dream and then having a woman realize that having a dream is her option. Like that she was never mad that she didn't have a dream. She thought she was living the dream. And once this asshole runs off, like to find his joy, then she's like, what am I in all of this for? And it's really charming, particularly considering like Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino are a married couple who work professionally and collaborate, but also in ways compete in this industry. And like the fact that having to manage a heterosexual man's ego is such a significant part of the show. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about was the parents and in-laws are so great. And in a very Amy Sherman-Palladino way that I was surprised that the character she picks to be the fabulous or the marvelous Mrs. Maisel's parents aren't the cliches of born in 1900 Jews that you would expect. It is a math professor at Columbia and like a sophisticated lady who went to college in Paris and who, when she is talking shit about people, doesn't slip into Yiddish, slips into French. Mm-hmm. And it's like really wonderful. But I think the best joke that has been on the show thus far is her father, the math professor, after they move back in with her parents, is complaining about her 3-year-old son being too entitled. And she's like, he's three. And the dad, played by Tony Shalhoub, just says, when I was three, I could resole a shoe. And it was perfect. And the fact that they make interesting choices with who her parents are mean that with her in-laws, it's Kevin Pollak and some woman, I forget her name, who just get to be the worst of the cliche of the factory-owning Jew and the Jewess who has matzah meal in her bag. Mm-hmm. It's so magnificently wonderful. It is a richly created world. I don't know that the stand-up she does is stand-up. Oh, and also, Alex Bornstein is a character we haven't seen. Like, it's a character from fucking 1950s lesbian pulp walked into, like, Mad Men, and there's something...
And it's like hanging out. You know, some of my lesbian friends gave me blowback about talking about Mrs. Maisel because they're like, well, why does she have to be this person who's characterized as lonely and pathetic and, like, you know, without any lovers and that kind of thing? And hopefully, like, whatever this spark is between her and Midge, like, can blossom in some way that has some erotic crackle or tension. And, you know, I didn't feel that way when I was watching it, but I do understand, like, how some chafed at that particular stereotype, I suppose, of the isolated and lone lesbian. But I feel like in 1958, you might be.
You are isolated and alone.
I also feel
also
like
that gives the series somewhere to go.
No, yeah. In lesbian pulp, totally. It always starts out with the Midwestern big-handed girl showing up to Greenwich Village, like, not really knowing exactly, like, you know, feeling desperate and alone.
Yeah.
And, it does show Alex Bornstein in a world that she's immersed in. Like, her background relationship with David Paymer. Like, I want to know so much about what this person's story is. But the biggest thing is just there's a way that Mad Men did a shitty job of having people walk into stories who existed at the time who we didn't see that much. I mean, there were, like, there was, like, a Black Secretary storyline that was interesting. Did you...
The lesbian photographer storyline. Do you remember that one?
No.
It's...
Zosia Mamet. Right?
Yeah, Zosia Mamet.
Oh, wait.
It was a really good character, but she just was in maybe two or three episodes.
Yeah. But Alex Bornstein is just like, that's somebody who fucking was in Greenwich Village at that time because it was the only place you legally could be that person.
Yeah.
And it's really good. So... Marvelous Ms. Maisel.
I also think it's the only, it's Amazon, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's the only Amazon show that got picked up this.
They need to figure out what they're doing.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Sort your shit out.
Okay, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about I, Tonya after this.
I'm Allegra Ringo.
And I'm Renee Colbert, and we host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog?
Renee, can I tell you about a dog I met this week?
I wish that you would. In turn, though, can I tell you about a dog hero?
May I tell you about a dog breed in a segment I like to call Mutt Minute?
Yeah, I would love that. Could we maybe talk about some dog tech?
Could we have some cool guests on, like Lin-Manuel Miranda, Nicole Byer, and Ann Wheaton?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
I'm in.
You're on board? What do you say we do all of this and put it into a podcast?
Yeah, okay.
You think? All right. Should we call it, like, I don't know, Can I Pet Your Dog?
Sure.
All right. What do you say we put it on every Tuesday on Maximum Fun?
Or on iTunes. Sounds good to me.
Meeting's over.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
And there is a brand new Oscar Beatty movie out that Margot Robbie stars in and produced about Tonya Harding, the figure skater who in 1994 we discovered had possibly collaborated with her ex-husband and bodyguard to attack one of her rivals for the gold at the Olympics. How invested was everybody in the story of Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan when it happened?
I'm just going to take over.
Okay.
And let you know that this was everything to me for a solid 2.5 years.
Really?
Yes. And probably pushed me into the bad behavior I cycled through for the next 3 years after that.
Inspired by Tanya?
Not inspired, but I just was so obsessed with this because I really felt the passion that Tanya had for it, and I really felt the gift that it was given to Nancy. So I really felt like Tanya actually worked her ass off. You could see it in her passion. Also, I was always attracted to women who did not look like the women that were constantly pushed into our faces.
Yeah.
And she was heavier, and she was kind of ratchet, and she didn't have the prettiest costumes. She didn't have the best hair. She had really chunky hands with these really big, thick red nails. She was just not what was pushed into our faces the entire time I was growing up watching figure skating.
The stiffest French braid I've ever
the
seen.
The stiffest French braid, the worst bleached hair, but there was the passion. And when she did that triple axel, I remember watching that, and I watched it again 4 times this weekend and cried. I remember watching that and the sheer joy on her. I'm getting chills right now and a little emotional. The joy on her face. That was like literally I worked 18, 19, 20 years for this and I did it.
Yeah.
And she did it with her own body and she did it with her own passion and gumption. And then when everything got ripped away from her and made into like this crazy, it was like the same time as OJ. And it was just, that's when I knew that the world just was always looking for something. And I knew every time it was time for her to get her scores or anything, I was praying she wouldn't be punished, and she would get punished every single time. And it was just heartbreaking watching that happen.
Margaret.
I was super into it too. I think there was something really captivating about it when it hit, when we were around that age. Like what were we? I mean, like in high school, basically.
I was in middle school.
Yeah.
I was in college.
Okay.
I was also in college.
We can all just make our confessions now. There was something just so soap opera about it, with like a blonde villain and the like blue blood looking brunette who seemed to be much more refined and elegant and, you know, what America wanted to think of itself as. Even though in actuality they were both from working class backgrounds.
That Nancy Kerrigan was self-possessed enough to say, why me, why anyone, is why I've always hated her. Because it's like, who else, when they got hit in the knee, would say, why anyone? It's like, bitch, calm down.
Wow.
Like, have your moment. Stop trying to be the princess.
I feel like we need Krish Liker in this conversation.
She was, no,
they
I
tried
showed,
to shade the triple axel.
I showed a bunch of kids who weren't even born. They were born in 94, so they don't count. But I showed them. They didn't know who she was, and I showed them the video of her saying, why me? Mm-hmm. And they were like, she needs to grow up.
Yeah.
That's literally what young people are saying
now. You guys are harsh. That girl got kneecapped.
Yeah, that was painful. But,
just a little bit. But, you know, there was something I remember thinking, too, about Tanya Harding that, like, almost made me uncomfortable watching her. Like, I definitely thought she was the better skater. Even back then, I was like, wow, she just has, like, true athleticism, like, boiling in every bone of her body. And I'm using the word boiling on purpose. It was, like, this ferocious, like jittering extreme energy that would just be coming off of her in waves and streams. And it was almost scary to watch her intensity.
Yeah.
And I think Margot Robbie did a really good job of nailing that part of the performance, like that kind of like almost like wild trapped animal energy that I think her mom also deliberately fostered in her in a very cruel way. You know, basically, I'm going to make you feel caged and beaten down at all times so that that comes out in your performance.
Yeah, the desire. I think that Tanya Harding's body was saturated with so much want mm-hmm. and desire mm-hmm. and thirst, and it was just like it was
the thirstiest.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was something about seeing that and seeing that kind of crack through whatever poise or veneer that she was supposed to possess,
right? Like which Nancy Kerrigan did possess.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, I have to say that in terms of the film. I enjoyed it, but I don't think I was completely won over by the film precisely because I was so into the 30 for 30 documentary, The Price for Gold. Mm. About as I know Winter has seen this about the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding relationship and their arc, and with interviews with the real women in the kind of contemporary moment, right? So like maybe just several years ago. And so that was really kind of emotional and moving to me. And Margot Robbie, you know, she offered a great performance, but it felt very much like a performance. I mean, I never got lost in Margot Robbie, and her cheekbones are too high to be Tonya Harding's. She looked too much like Nancy, in fact.
Listen,
she's stunning. She is so beautiful that at times it like almost took me out of it.
Well, I mean, it's the trope of pretty girl plays ugly to try to win an Academy Award, and she didn't do full ugly, but she did do trashy.
She did trashy ugly, yeah.
And yes.
The thing is like, hearing her Australian accent, working so hard to be a trashy American accent, just put me in mind of To Die For, which is such a structurally similar film. From The Confessionals to the like Act of Violence, all of it just made me think about this movie from 20 years ago that was structurally so similar about what's wrong, you know, you're anyone in America, you have to be on TV or whatever it is she said. You're not anyone in America unless you're on TV. That's what it was. But I did love that it was rooted in actual conversations that the screenwriter had with these people, because there was such honesty in lines like, Nancy Kerrigan got hit once, I got hit every day of my life. But there's the thing of like, the film couldn't decide if it was sympathetic or judgmental, and it didn't need to because she's trash. So it was a little bit just playing the Honey Boo Boo game.
The tonality was very patchy throughout. That was one of the things too, you know, where I couldn't get if it was playing for kind of broad camp in its own way in a very deliberate manner, or and you know, whether or not it was trying to strike up a kind of more sympathetic and, you know, a kind of tone of realness about, like, these are the struggles that this person went through. And there were those kind of sweet and sincere moments, but the unevenness in the tone was also jarring for me, whereas, you know, actually hearing Tonya in her own words on The Price of Gold, like, that shit destroyed me. I was just, like, sobbing, you know. Yeah. And I did not sob at I, Tonya.
I cried like 4 times. I cried when she did the triple. I cried when her and her mom, like the relationship between her and Allison Janney plays LaVon, like, I mean, that's exactly who I felt like she was, even though she rarely spoke in that time, in that era. She wasn't the coach. She was just the mom, stage mom. But that's the persona I got. You got that, like, she had a cold mother, because Nancy's parents were always like in the stands cheering, and like, and she was just cold, void, like not present, but she was 100% present because she was focused on her. And I felt like their relationship felt similar to mine and my mother's, where you just have someone who's constantly beating into you, whether, I'm not saying my mother was physically abusive, but just this notion that she wants you to be this certain way and also be who you were, the way you grew up. And she wanted her to be so many different things. And Tonya's own sole focus, which I admire her for, was just, I want to get this gold medal. I want to be successful. This is all I know how to do. And I think when they took it all away from her, that's the part where, and she had a part in it. Because it was like, it wasn't like she went to go work at the, you know, the Pig and Whistle and she lost that job, but she couldn't go get another job at another Chili's or whatever. Once you're she can't skate, she can't make money off of it, she can't play anything else, she can't teach, she can't coach, she can't even basically go onto a rink now.
Yeah.
And that's all you knew? That part really
fucked me
up.
That we didn't hit the tragedy of that anymore. I mean, and they tried to underline it, but it's a movie. Give us more than a scene at a court to understand what it means to Tonya Harding that she can't skate anymore.
Yeah.
But Allison Janney, I thought, yes, she was playing for laughs, but she played a villain for laughs.
Yeah.
And I feel like her not being too sentimental about anything really elevated that performance. Mm-hmm. It made it something wonderful to watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that performance, that was intense. Like, I felt very uncomfortable with it at first because I felt like it was being played for laughs. And I was like, but this woman's a monster.
Yeah.
Like, she's beating her child with a hairbrush. She's insisting her child pee on the rink as opposed to getting off the rink and using the bathroom like a regular person. And I didn't really know, like, that part of the movie for me was hard to settle with. I think as the movie went along and I got more settled into her performance, I felt okay about it. And the fact that they did at the end just land on her as like a complete and total villain. And I mean, not a villain in like, ooh, a badass, let's celebrate it kind of way, but just truly like a pathetic jerk. You know what I mean? But in the beginning, it felt like they were going to almost play her as sort of a badass that you could love. And that was making me really...
It made Tanya tougher. And
yeah. And like, it was sitting wrong with me for the first like half an hour or so. I mean, Allison Janney was amazing. Her performance was great. It was more just the tonal handling of her character that was making me squirm a bit.
Emily Heller from Baby Geniuses, also a Maximum Fun podcast, commented, like, this is Tanya Harding is a woman who was punished for performing femininity wrong. And it's such an interesting thing to think about in that sport, because during that period of time, you had such a tension between femininity, Katarina Witt, who could barely land a double, and then you had athleticism coming from women like Tanya Harding and Surya Bonaly, who could do a motherfucking backflip.
Yeah.
And constantly doing poorly because they weren't smiling real pretty.
They weren't restrained enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, how do you feel like this is a story of gender performance done wrong?
It's a story of so many different like degrees of performance done wrong.
Uh-huh.
Class performance, obviously, right?
Yeah.
You know, that she has to slaughter a bunch of rabbits to get a fur coat.
That's
essentially
possibly the best scene in the movie.
Yeah.
But most certainly it is about like how one's gender performance is bound up with class and your class mobility, frankly.
Yeah.
And that if you don't know how to smile properly and be polite and put some polish to that, if you dance to ZZ Top, if you skate to ZZ Top, you're not going to rise to the top of like a parochial profession where people are insisting on policing presentation, and presentation is all about policing femininity.
Yeah, I think in this case, you can't extract the femininity from the class. I think, you know, if you take the two of them, and like I said, they were both from working class backgrounds, but Nancy feels like the kind of girl that could have married up.
Yeah.
And that nobody would ever know that she was from that working class background. Whereas Tonya Harding, she was never going to be able to shed that skin. And that's, I think, what made America uncomfortable watching her, that she just so clearly telegraphed her, like, super white trash origins, and that she could never move beyond that in the eyes of the judges and everybody watching her.
And the wanting it too much is also part of failing at that performance of proper femininity and proper class mobility. It's like, if you want it too much, then, ooh, we don't want to see that.
But the thing is that, like, everything we knew about the Olympics up to that point, because I think this blew the roof off what the Olympics are working with, is that you do a really good job, you get a Wheaties box, you get to have a McDonald's commercial, you get to appear in, like, Sesame Street. There's all this, there's the road to riches that come from the athleticism. You get to be like Michael Jordan.
It's really about endorsement. In the end,
I mean, and it's really about endorsements.
And you know, Nancy was getting them and Tonya wasn't.
Two things that I think really affected that with the 94 Olympics were an expansion of what television was a little bit, that you went from just, I mean, you had deep expansion of what network coverage was. And as time would go on, we would start getting cable coverage and we would just see so much more of it. But the thing of having two Winter Olympics within 2 years of each other meant all of the same people showed back up again. So you were able to see, oh, wow, that girl who jumps better than everybody else still is losing to these women who just, you know, appear nicer.
Yeah. And also, like, I feel the introduction to her, you know, they always do the sort of the background.
Yeah.
About who's, this is where they come from. This is who they are. I feel like they played a part.
I call it a mom with cancer video.
Oh, God. There were so many of those that year. Yeah. And for Tanya, sort of this notion that she was white trash. People need to understand, when you're raised that way by someone who's, And she wasn't a traditional stage mom, because usually she's putting all her passions that didn't come to pass into the child. she didn't ever want to be an ice skater. She identified in her that this is what you're good at, and this is what you're going to be good at because I say so. And then by
you could make money in the ice capades.
And you could make money in the ice capades. And I think there's, you know, her coming from PNW and growing up in this world and having her father ripped out of her life and then trying
What's
to
PNW
Pacific Northwest. Oh, okay.
And then having this Jeff Galuli, who, by the way, is just to this day, even in Sebastian Stan's performance, what a just loser.
The gentle air of dumbness.
The gentle air of dumbness. And when Allison Janney, when Lavanna says, you fuck dumb, you don't marry dumb.
Yeah.
And her knowing right then and there that her mom is right. And that's the decision that she made. But she made a decision.
But in this film, I feel like
she could do nothing right but skate.
We are so unselfconscious about telling stories about trash in this way. Mm-hmm. Like this very Honey Boo Boo, like, isn't it funny that those people are like that? Thank God I'm not them. And it just feels so icky to me.
But we give them so much rope and then we let them hang themselves and then we move on to another thing. We've done it with everybody, that whole vertical you're talking about.
Yeah.
The only people who can rise to the occasion is because they lay into this white trashness are teen moms.
I know, but it's like, it's terrible and gross to be sending, like, to be telling that story about essentially what other stories are we telling about working class people?
Well,
you know?
I know people who act. Who reacted very virulently to this portrayal, this class portrayal. Like a friend of mine who programs like queer cinema stuff, like showed a ripped, destroyed copy of the screener and was like, this was a piece of trash. He treated people like it was a circus.
Yeah.
And I don't want nothing to do with it. Whereas, you know, other people I know were more ambivalent or like, you know, understood the film to actually be a rehabilitation of Tonya Harding, right? So, I mean, but I do think that that is about the tonality and like that the film never settled on a kind of tone, and never committed to a tonality. And even the little asides where, you know, the characters were speaking directly to camera, mm-hmm. like they either had to do that more or cut it out altogether because it happened like twice.
Yeah.
But nobody knows what the truth is.
Yeah.
Everybody has a different version of what happened. So I don't think that's why the tone is so uneven, because Galuli says one thing, that dumb fuck, that other guy that it was his friend,
Eckhart.
But it was, Eckhart. But it everybody's a different version.
Interesting that the screenplay made gestures at sort of like, Tonya Harding shoots at him, shoots at Jeff Galuli with a shotgun, then looks at the camera and says, I never did that. In a way that's very early 2000s, like very, like, you know, adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't do it enough for that to be sort of like part of the texture of the film. It just kind of happened some.
A little randomly to me, you know, and that's where it lost its sort of, you know, like that. And yet it was sentimental in certain instances as well.
Yeah, I guess I didn't find the style as inconsistent as you did. I think for me it was more like the style like was there without substance often, or that it just overreached entirely and was too cutesy in certain moments, like, you know, where there was like split screen type of things and breaking the fourth wall. A lot of that felt a bit unnecessary to me. But I do think it has something to do with, like, what is the real story and did she really deserve to have her image rehabbed? Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I think that America treated her poorly in the sense that because she did sort of signify these, you know, Pacific Northwest, you know, rural kind of trashy ideas, like people like were already down on her before that attack even happened. But then there's a part of me that's like, if she knew about that attack and planned that attack, then fuck her at the same time. That's like a horrible thing to do.
I think that the tone of the film could have been held together by a better actor. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like Margot Robbie did the best work that she had in her, but I think if you had somebody who were a more confident performer who was able to make some choices and not just be sliding along with the screenplay the whole time, that it could have provided a unifying energy and texture.
Well, that makes me think about Nicole Kidman going back to Die For.
Yeah.
Who is brilliant in that role.
Right.
A friend of mine actually suggested, the friend who I saw it with, Lucas Hildebrand, who's a film scholar, was like, you know, Amy Adams should have played that role.
Yep. Oh,
she did
God.
Really amazing working class stuff.
Like, look at, yes. I mean, that face would have worked so much better.
Yes.
And then imagine everything she brought to Junebug in somebody who's morally ambiguous. That would have been exciting.
Oh my God, that's such a good call.
The other call that he made too is like, we should have made this movie 10 years ago with Lindsay Lohan and Anne Hathaway.
I feel like I've been waiting
for,
this movie forever. Yeah. So I'm happy with the outcome.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I like the investment, lunch money, buying the supermarket books, watching it, you know, not really knowing what I wanted to care about so much in my life at 12, 13 or 14. But like if I had something that I cared about as much as ice skating, I guess I would probably be just as intense. I just thought it was amazing. I've been waiting
for
it my entire life.
I enjoyed it. Like, I definitely enjoyed it.
I totally enjoyed it, too. Like, in many respects, I enjoyed it. I feel like my emotional connection to it was more about, like, the empathy that I'd cultivated in these past few years, probably since that 30 for 30 documentary for Tanya. Because my memory of this as a college student or whatever was that was all of the parodies. And all the cartoonishness of
Attack
everyone
of the 5 foot
involved.
2 women.
Exactly. And all the cartoonishness involved. And I was just like, you know, it was a very distracted absorber of these things.
I was a little sad that we did not get Michelle Kwan, like, first springing into existence in this whole thing.
No, it wasn't. That was Christy Yamaguchi.
No. It was Michelle Kwan was the person who was possibly going to go as the other member of the
Christy Yamaguchi is the one in 92 that she was, we should have had a Yamaguchi.
I know, when they were considering not having Tanya Harding on the Olympic team for the United States, the person that they were considering was Michelle Kwan. Thank you.
You're welcome. I just think that there's something, I'll just say this. When you're looking for something that captures a moment and tells you sort of behind the scenes, this is why I love People versus OJ. I think with time, would I have cared about this at 17? No. But the early 90s were really wacky for entertainment because the entertainment was news. So the news became the entertainment. I think now, because of the things I've gone through in my life, I see someone who deserves. I mean, look, do I want to watch a Nancy Kerrigan movie? No.
Nobody wants to.
I don't
want to
watch a Nancy Kerrigan movie. I'm not interested in that.
It's just smiling and sharpening blades the whole time.
I did watch interviews with both of them, like more recent interviews. And why is Nancy Kerrigan just
gone and vaping?
Well, kind of like dead behind the eyes.
Because her father murdered her brother.
Oh. Okay, I want to watch that movie.
Yeah, I do want to watch that movie.
I think the brother shot the father. One of those two things happened. And then I think her husband embezzled like a ton of money.
Oh, yeah. There was
she had a lot of miscarriages too, like 6 miscarriages.
Yeah, so there's all of that. And
she's had a rough life in her own
right. So guys, Lillehammer is haunted.
And then also, finally, the last time we've seen her, she was literally skating in Kris Jenner's backyard. So look, life ain't going that great. She's not getting an Oscar.
Makes Oksana's DUI seem a whole lot better. Welcome back. Oh, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Are stacks of unread books taking over your apartment?
Do you constantly miss your train stop because you're caught up in reading?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We party hard.
And by party hard, we mean read books.
So join us every Thursday on Reading Glasses, a Maximum Fun podcast about reading and book culture.
Get more out of your reading life.
We'll help you conquer your to-be-read pile.
Get out of that book slump.
And squeeze more reading time into your busy day. Learn how to read better.
Wow, that was good.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brennan. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, what is your current jam?
I have a current jam from St. Vincent, and it took me a while to get into this latest album of hers, Mass Seduction. I think because the first song I heard was Los Angeles, which is a play on Los Angeles, and it pretty much traffics and like all of the tropes about Los Angeles being this vapid, you know, wasteland of nobody ever aging and plastic surgery and blah, blah, blah. And I kind of felt like, you know, I've kind of heard this critique before. Yeah. I'm not that excited about it. And the Jack Antonoff producer vibes were so strong on it that it took me a while to make friends with this album. But the entryway for me has been the song Pills, which I know Karen played as a jam a couple months ago, maybe right when I was in labor. Who knows?
Probably.
But this is my jam off of Mass Seduction.
From healer to dealers and then back again. From guru to voodoo and voodoo to zen. Pills to wake, pills to sleep. Pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think. Pills, pills, pills for the family. Pills to grow, pills to shrink. Pills, pills, pills and a good stick of drinks. Pills to fuck, pills to eat. Pills, 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 have a good chill sleep.
I'll say what I said last time. Kristen Stewart fucked her up.
I thought it was Cara Delevingne.
No, it was definitely Kristen.
It probably was Case too. I have to say, I like this album more than I like the Lord album, which is ending up at the top of everyone's best of 2017 list.
What puts this above the Lord album for you?
I think that for me, like, it just seems to have a lot more sort of complexity to it, like mm-hmm. tonal complexity, emotional depth, like, also political, like, you know, juice. Commentary and juice.
Yeah. Annie Clark's been at it for kind of a while at this point. Like, this is maybe fifth or sixth album. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Karen, you got a jam?
I have a very, like, lighthearted, fun jam from one of my favorite bands from the 80s, and it is General Public's Never You Done That. You know, I'm home a lot more during the holiday season. It's only an hour away, good old Riverside, California. We loved ska out there and different pop iterations of ska. And, you know, General Public was great because they were the kind of bubblegum gateway for a lot of kids of my generation to some other harder stuff. Rankin Roger and Dave Wakeling were originally in the English Beat, just called originally just called The Beat, actually, in the UK. And their album All the Rage in 1984 had a lot of great songs on it, and people remember Tenderness, and they kind of bust that song out.
Yeah,
people bust that out for Christmas time, but I find Never You Done That to me is just more charming. There's some whistling in it, and anyway, I hope people enjoy it as a light little, like, little candy.
Looking at Margaret with a song that 80s playing, I could only imagine just how low her blouses went, like below the knee blouses with leggings underneath in 1987.
Yeah.
And crispy bangs.
That's correct. Except the leggings would have had stirrups on them.
I'm sorry, stirrup pants. I forgot.
How could you?
Winter, you got a jam?
Yes. Beck's new album, Colors, to me is one of the top five best albums of 2017. He's the only one where I can separate the man from Crazy
the
Religion, the Scientology. No. I can separate him and Tom Cruise. Come at me. But I really love Beck. I do.
Second generations are allowed.
Yeah, second generations are allowed.
Have you always loved Beck? Because I seem to remember, I don't know, some Grammys discussion we had, you were kind of like, eh.
Well, because he beat Beyonce, right? No?
Yeah. No, I don't even think I cared then.
Okay.
We can talk about how much I'm disinterested in Beyonce now. I love the song Wow, but I love the whole album. But I think that this album is his response to Kanye talking shit. Because it's actually super hip-hoppy, kind of rappy, and has, like, better beats than Pablo Sorry. This shit knocks in the fucking 330i. This shit fucking knocks. If somebody pulls up to me and is like, what's that playing? I'll be like, oh, it's Beck Wow. Get to know it.
And ladies and gentlemen, my jam is from Lizzo. Lizzo is back. Lizzo is doing solidly good work as she's been doing low these many years. Let's listen to it.
100% that bitch, even when I'm crying.
Is there a better lyric on the planet? Is there a... Lizzo is so wonderful.
I'm gonna tweet that right now.
Her songs are so good. And like her firm commitment to always having two other big girls as backup dancers in most situations is like, it's lovely. It's weird when things, when you see things and they change, you are like, oh, I didn't know I could think about myself that way. But like her having big girls as backup dancers and Kelly Marie Tran's face being all up in there in Star Wars this week were things that made me say, hey, guy, the rules of media you learned do not exist anymore.
Yep.
We are in a beautiful place.
Yep.
All right, you guys, you are listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Karen Tongson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to JWM NYC for the 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already, please review us. Also, we need more people giving us 5-star reviews. Margaret's pregnancy is complete, and we can start making jokes about how we'll kill her again if you don't give us 5-star reviews. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the punctual Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.